this last one? Still around?
Thank you. Just a minute.
Thank you, Your Honour. Now, Fonterra, as part of its joint case with Dairy New Zealand, has provided opening submissions as part of the main hearing. It had only very briefly addressed counsel's discharges in those legal submissions. And so what I do propose is just to hand up one pager that I'll speak to now as far as...
Thank you very much.
...introducing the case with Fonterra. And so, as outlined in those opening submissions, Fonterra is strongly supportive of Te Waimana. Fonterra's interests in terms of Plan Change 1 span both the diffuse and point source discharge aspects. It is supportive of Plan Change 1 as an important first step in delivering on to Te Waimana's aspirations. All resource users must do their part across all four components. As with the balance of Plan Change 1, Fonterra has worked hard to reach agreement on provisions in the context of the point source discharges, and its position is closely aligned with the Council in relation to the proposed point source discharge policies, and there is one subtle point of difference that I'll address shortly in relation to Policy 12A. In terms of the point source discharge provisions, for Fonterra, they're relevant in that it has a network of 5 dairy manufacturing sites across the region. And so in Ms. O'Rourke's evidence, you would have seen the detail of those sites and their discharges in detail. In questioning yesterday, Commissioner Hodges asked various witnesses about the improvements over time, and so I have drawn out for you there in relation to 2 of those sites, Te Rapa and Te Awamutu, the improvements that Fonterra has realised over the last just over a decade.
Are there any other proposals? I mean, I think that Litchfield is relatively recent. Are there any further manufacturing sites in the pipeline?
So, not beyond those 5, but in terms of those 5, there are reconsenting. So, for example, you have seen with Rekaroa that it is currently going through a reconsenting process, and Ms. O'Rourke can certainly speak to that as well.
Thank you.
So, going through the points that remain outstanding, the key one where there is a difference between Fonterra and the Council relates to Policy 12A. And so, as outlined in the joint witness statement, Mr. Willis, Fonterra's planning witness, agrees with the wording proposed by Genesis that you've just heard from Mr. Matthews in relation to. So that is to remove reference to appropriate within 12A, and then instead to refer to reasonable mixing being taken into account. So in this regard, Fonterra shares the concerns of the territorial authorities OG and Genesis in relation to the use of appropriate, in that it does add a further potential test, and that creates uncertainty or unnecessary confusion and complexity. The use of the phrase taken into account in my submission acknowledges the linkages between the two concepts of BPO and reasonable mixing, but doesn't blink a consideration, and so certainly agree with my friend for Genesis talking about those different considerations of the overall merits of the discharge, and then separate consideration of BPO and reasonable mixing. There are two other points just with which to briefly address you on. The first relates to policy 12B1. And so in the questioning over the last day or so, it has demonstrated uncertainty as to where it applies against the reasonable mixing zone. The proposed wording now includes reference to section 107.2. Now, 107.2 is an exception to 107.1, and that is all about effects beyond the mixing zone. And so it would be absurd in my submission if there are a situation where section 107.2 applied to allow significant adverse effects beyond the reasonable mixing zone, but not within the reasonable mixing zone, because the effects inevitably will be greater within the reasonable mixing zone. And so in my submission, there does need to be some additional clarity as far as making sure that the intent behind those words plays out when it comes to the real world. And so as far as the different ways to deal with it, the other suggestion has been just removing policy 12B1. Now, the risk with that is in the context of Te Tiriti Whai Mana and the allowance of significant adverse effects within the reasonable mixing zone. And so that is a matter for the court to consider. The final point I wish to address is in relation to the proposals to import EPCFM definitions of offsetting and compensation. Fonterra does not agree with those. They are not necessarily like for like, and importantly, in the context of PC1, policy 13 includes a number of particular considerations that take into account, for example, if it's a reconsenting, how much effort has already or progress has already been made in the previous term, for example, of that consent. And so there are a series of other considerations within policy 13, and so immediately defaulting to the MPSFM definitions in my submission would potentially nullify or negate some of those important considerations within policy 13. So those were the only matters that I wish to address you on by way of opening.
Your Honour, I should probably just again for transparency say that before Fonterra existed, I was the project manager for the design of the Tiamutu treatment plant. And within 2 weeks of having got it into operation, someone decided to test it by dropping a large vat of milk into the plant and overloaded it by a factor of 5 or 6. And luckily the plant recovered within 2 weeks. So I was, just wanted to let you know that I am familiar with that plant.
Thank you, sir. So with that, I'll call the first witness, Ms. O'Rourke.
Thank you.
Do you solemnly, sincerely, and truthfully affirm and declare that the favours you are about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Good morning, Ms. O'Rourke. Is your full name Suzanne Patricia O'Rourke?
It is.
And you're the National Environmental Policy Manager at Fonterra?
Yes.
And you prepared a statement of evidence dated 28 July 2023? and your qualifications and experience as set out in section 2 of that statement. And do you have any corrections to make to that?
No, I don't.
So, with that, is it true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief? Thank you. Please answer any questions.
No, thank you, sir.
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
Muldoon.
No, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Muldoon.
No, thank you, sir.
Ms. Garvin.
No, thank you, sir.
Ms. Olman.
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Turner.
No, thank you, sir.
All right, well, I think that's everyone, isn't it? Any questions, Ms. Muldoon? No, thank you, Commissioner Rain.
No, thank you, Your
Honor. No? Yet another witness who gets off scot-free.
Well, I think, again, it's a testament to the clarity of your evidence. Thank you, so I look for excuse.
Next up, with that, we'll move to Ontario's final witness, Mr. Willis.
Thank you.
Do you swear by magic oath that evidence you're about to give the report shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Good morning, Mr. Willis.
Good morning.
Can you confirm, please, that your full name is Jared Matthew Willis?
Yes, that's correct.
And you are a director of InFocus, a planning consultancy?
Yes.
And you have filed, prepared two statements of evidence in this matter, a primary statement of evidence dated 28 July. And a rebuttal statement dated 11 August.
Yes.
And your qualifications and experience are as set out in your primary statement of evidence.
Correct.
And you're also involved in two different rounds of planning conferencing, but for current purposes, the point source discharge related conferencing with a joint witness statement dated 18 September of this year.
That's correct.
Do you have any corrections to make to your evidence?
No corrections, other than to observe that the positions of mine set out in the joint statement obviously subsumes the provisions that were attached to my evidence.
Thank you. And so is your evidence true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
It is.
Thank you. Please answer any questions.
All right.
No, thank you, too.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
So while I'm waiting for the microphone box, I just wondered if I had intended to do so earlier, but just seek leave to have my witness at the...
Yes, of course.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Willis.
Morning.
So I just want to follow on from the submissions that were made by your counsel in relation to the effect of Section 107.2. And just looking at Policy 12B in and of itself doesn't allow for the significant adverse effects on aquatic life and toxic adverse effects to occur, does it?
No, and it doesn't. My understanding was it was inserted to ensure that they couldn't be offset. You couldn't seek to offset those effects. You had to deal with them by avoiding them somewhat.
Yes, so it's a different situation from saying this is a policy which effectively requires you to consider those things. It's requiring you to consider those things, but in the context of a residual adverse effect. That's correct?
Yes.
And then whether you should then address that residual adverse effect through offsetting or compensation?
I've always understood this, and it is quite difficult, as I think people found, but I've certainly understood it to be aimed at saying there are certain effects where the offsetting provision ought not to apply, so you cannot have an effect that's so egregious that you can simply offset it somewhere else. You need to deal with it as and where it occurs. That's my understanding.
And so to that extent, that's attempting to limit the discretion of the decision maker in relation to the situations where offsetting might apply. Is that correct?
Yes, I've described it as a directive policy in that regard. Yeah.
mixing zone, where the mixing zone applies, if you had reference there to section 1072.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I've always understood section 1072 to apply outside the reasonable mixing zone, and therefore it raises doubt as to how it applies in this context.
Yeah. Yes, so potentially a solution might be to remove that clause in its entirety.
That's one solution to remove the uncertainty, but it does. I guess you'd have to observe that it would. Weaken the provision to the extent that it did seek to ensure that within the reasonable mixing zone you couldn't have those effects.
So it's a bit of a conundrum really, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And have you got any solution other than removing it to address that?
I've been thinking about it quite a lot over the last few hours, but nothing has popped into my mind, unfortunately. I guess it all depends on to what extent the provision without the reference to section 107 is problematic.
It's fair to say, isn't it, that any decision maker is going to have to consider section 107 in any event, isn't it?
Yes, well, yes.
Because you can't grant a discharge permit without... Or if those effects occur, unless the exceptions in section 1072 arise.
Correct. So if the AE determined that those effects could occur, you'd go to 107. You'd look to see whether you could avoid them. If you couldn't, you'd go to 107 to see whether the exceptions existed. That's right.
And would you also agree that without the reference to section 107, that I understand that you support, that there is a potential issue as to the extent to which the decision maker's discretion could be fettered with respect to the application of section 1072?
Sorry, you did lose me there, I'm sorry.
So to the extent that section 107, the reference to section 1072 in that clause allows for consideration of those exceptions.
Yes.
If that reference were not there, then is there an argument that a decision maker may then not have to refer to section 107?
Well, I would say no. Well, but certainly if I was acting in an application context, you would draw that to the attention of the process. I guess there is a risk that might be greater debate about that. But I guess it's almost a legal point rather than a planning point.
Yes, that's
true.
Thank you.
I have
nothing further. Thank you, Mr.
Wilder. Thank you. Mr. Baldwin, Clutter will
serve.
Thank you, Mr. Wilder.
No, you're
Ms. Garvin.
No, thanks.
Thank you.
Ms. Ong. Thank you, sir. Good morning, Mr. Willow.
Morning.
Can I take you, please, to paragraph 16.2 of your evidence and sheet? So, there you're discussing policies 11 to 14. And you say, in your opinion, these policies need to be clear about two key factors, and the first is what obligation applies to reduce the discharge of contaminants at the time an existing discharge permit is renewed. And then you say, in the absence of another more sophisticated allocation regime, the most appropriate policy direction is to require a reduction of contaminant discharge that corresponds to the proportional change required, etc. What do you mean there by in the absence of another more sophisticated allocation regime? Are you discussing there an allocation between point and non-point discharges?
I'm just generically referring to an allocation regime that would determine that, but potentially more than that, as to what proportion of the available load in this case was allocated to different users or industries or sectors, however it might be done.
Thank you. And then you say in B, the inevitable need for new discharges and fully allocated catchments and for replacement discharge consents that have effects beyond the mixing zone, how and where can offsetting and compensation requirements apply to ensure social and economic needs. Now, do you agree with the proposition that offsetting and compensation essentially provides an opportunity where otherwise your consent may be declined?
Yes.
And in the questions from Mr. Munhinnock, I see that paragraph 9, you said Fonterra doesn't agree with the proposals to import the NPSFM definitions of offsetting and compensation, and that would negate the matters within policy 13. And you would be familiar with the NPSFM definitions of offsetting.
The principles, you mean?
Well, there are definitions and then there are principles.
Oh, yeah.
The definitions are for an offset means a measurable conservation outcome resulting from actions that are intended to, and then it goes on to discuss the terms no net loss and net gain.
Yes, yes, yes.
So just talking about the definitions at the moment, wouldn't those definitions in the NPSFM be useful additions here so that everybody knows what the terms offset and compensation mean?
Well, I guess there's two ways to approach it. One is to do that, and one is to do what we've done here, which is take a more generic approach, which doesn't reference the NPS itself and which tries to provide guidance and flexibility through the policy framework, particularly policy 13, which is obviously the way this is done, because preceded the NPS framework, I guess that made sense. So you could go either way. I mean, it's gone, in my mind, the way it has. There are relevant factors, the council pointed this out earlier too, but there are relevant provisions within Policy 13, which I think at first blush, anyway, having looked at it in the last little while, may be in conflict with some of the definitional principles of the NPS. And I think it could be problematic simply to import the NPS architecture into the plan at this point. I think it will potentially set up some conflicts that are unhelpful.
Well, first of all, if there is a conflict, doesn't that provide a bit of a problem because there's a requirement of the court to give effect to an NPS event?
Within the scope of appeals and those sorts of things, yes. But I think what we're dealing with here in particular is the idea that in every case you would need to show, you may need to show an offset which is a betterment, more than what effect you're creating. And I think in the context of the point source discharges at issue here, we do need to be conscious that of the factors that are set out in Policy 13, really, which is about the extent to which large reductions have already been made, the extent to which you might be at the end of a technology curve and those sorts of things, which might mean that doing more is difficult. So I think there are some potential conflicts there which I just think will be, having not had the opportunity to think through fully, might be problematic.
Is that the only part of Policy 13 you can't
do? Let me just find it. There's a number of parts of 13 which I think are really important in this context, but certainly C, D, and E would be ones which, D specifically refers to offsetting and compensation, of course. I think you'd need to do a full analysis of the extent to which there is some conflict or overlap or inconsistency between the NPS's approach to offsetting and what's proposed in Policy 13, otherwise we'll end up with a bit of a muddle.
That doesn't arise if you're just referring to the definition side. It may arise if you're referring to the principles as well.
I'd have to have a good look at those definitions, to be honest. so I can't really probably ask
right.
that in a formal way. I'm sorry.
All right. Just finally, so if we look at policy 12B, Roman numeral 5, which talks about what occurs when there's a replacement discharge permit.
Mm.
So it says the measure results in a reduction of the replacement permit's contribution to the load of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and all microbial pathogens. That is in proportion with the load reduction required to achieve the interim target attribute state and steady progression towards the 80-year target attribute state. So is my understanding correct that if you have a replacement discharge, you may, through mitigations and an application of the BPO, reduce, say we talk about nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus to a certain extent. If you haven't reduced them sufficient to comply with this proportionate requirement here, then you do an offset somewhere to add that onto it?
Correct.
Right, thank you very much.
No questions, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Willis, the I appreciate you haven't had a chance to do the analysis that you'd like to use. I'm just wondering, in broad terms, and without any commitment to altering policies as a result, is there anything about the definitions of aquatic compensation? Is there anything about the definitions of aquatic compensation and aquatic offset in the national policy statement that immediately strikes you as different than or somehow inconsistent with the ways in which offset or compensation have been used in resource management over the last, I don't know, decade or two?
So the question is,
is there anything that, I suppose, let me put it this way, I read through those definitions and nothing jumps out at me as suggesting, oh gosh, that is different than the way in which those words have been used in some of the case law to discuss offset and compensation. I accept there's been a lot of debate and quite a few differences of opinion about the appropriateness of compensation or offsetting in any particular circumstance. But that really comes down to whether or not you allow it or provide for it, or whether you say, no, internalise and be done with it. Don't let the externality be dealt with in some other way that could amount to trading it off.
Look, in the few moments I had after the last question, I was just glancing at myself to refresh my memory. And I think the definitions themselves look entirely unproblematic, if I can put it that way. But I totally agree. I think the point is how you judge what an appropriate degree of offset is.
Right.
That's, and what you should take into account in making that determination. Those are the issues, I think.
It seems to me that without delivering any decision, in the event that the court were having to construe the word compensation or offset, it would be entirely appropriate for counsel or a planning expert such as yourself to say, well, you know, the terms are defined in the NPSFN, and so in a broad contextual sense, we could look at those words to get some guidance as to what offset or compensation may mean. And having said that, I suppose the thing is, why can't we leave it there and
say that's how they should be interpreted in these policies.
Yes, look, as I say, I would agree with that. I don't think there's any mystery around what these concepts mean after a number of years and decades probably having thought out and tried to apply them. The key issue that I see is, as I say, really, is what would be relevant to take into account in terms of how much of an offset.
Oh, yeah.
We try to think about these things in a very metric way, but of course we often aren't in that metric space. We're dealing with qualitative analysis, and what should be taken into account should be taken into account the fact that there's been a significant reduction achieved by the community over the past, and so the offset might be smaller than it might otherwise be.
Exactly.
As long as it retains that flexibility, I think that's fine.
And it may well be that the desire for quantification comes hard up against something like cultural considerations. And you just say, well, that's completely incommensurable in metric terms to, say, the amount of nitrogen or phosphorus or E. coli in the discharge.
Frequently. Yes.
And absolutely.
Yes.
Do you think, in your experience in planning and perhaps in preparing planning documents, that there are times when the drive to define a term goes further than the need to define it?
Yes, I would say so. We end up with lots of probably unnecessary definitions.
And that poses a risk if in crafting that definition you haven't thought of something that then crops up in an application 5 years down the track.
Yes, the tendency is for them to be narrowed and defined very tightly,
yeah.
And also sometimes to import rules and standards within the definitions.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Willis.
Anything arising?
Thank you very much, Mr. Willis. You're excused.
And that completes the presentation of Fonterra's case.
Thank you. We come to Fish and Game. Ms. Omri?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I said yesterday that there were some slight amendments to the provisions that Fish and Game is supporting with respect to policy 12.
Yes.
So I'll just turn those up. I did email this to Council, and before starting my legal submissions, I'll just note that the changes are yellow highlighted here. So the Fish and Game is now accepting that the key issue for the purposes of this policy is the load in terms of achieving the target attribute states. The slight difference between other parties is in policy 12C, Fish and Game doesn't want to preclude the consideration of other matters, so that relates to this issue around the word include versus the word are. But I'll get to this in my submissions. And in relation to diversions, which is 4C, Roman numeral 3, continues to consider that shouldn't be limited to load because diversions can increase or exacerbate the rate or location of the contaminant. So, wishes to see the original decision preserved in that respect rather than that being having that confined to load. But I will come to that in my submissions. So, if I can start with the submission.
Thank you.
First of all, I haven't included in these submissions any reference to Objective 3, but Fish and Game supports the Regional Council's position on Objective 3 that it is not necessary to change the word assist to enable
because there are other provisions in the Waikato Regional Plan that provide for enablement. So that's not covered in my submissions because Fish and Game supports the council on that. So, paragraph one, Fish and Game supports the council's post-conferencing version in which policy 11 is subject to policies 12 and 13. Here, I'm pointing out, or Ms. Maher has pointed out, that it is simply odd in policy 11 to have the word subject to policies 12 and 13 provide for the continued operation of regional significant infrastructure and then have regard to the need to achieve objective one. So I say, although context is everything, the words have regard to note to objective one could be interpreted to read down the objective and to imply that its achievement could be overridden by other considerations. So Ms. Maher's solution is to simply, it would say, subject to policies 12 and 13 and objective 1. Now, there may be other solutions, but the submissioners that have regard to is not correct because we're seeking to achieve objective 1 and that's the requirement in the Act. So if I can turn to...
What about the option, which we're now discussing in a range of situations, of saying, well, the purpose of the policies in the plan change are to achieve the objectives. We don't need the phrase at all. We can simply say, provide for the continued operation and development of regionally significant infrastructure. Now, that provision must itself be subject to, or in the context of, all of the objectives.
Yes, I think Fish and Game would prefer to leave in the words subject to policies 12 and 13.
I wasn't referring to that at this stage. I understand there's still the issue of the hierarchy within the policies. I'm just saying that in terms of section 30, whichever the provision is in the 60s, these policies must be read in the context of the relevant objectives.
Yes, from my perspective, that would be acceptable. I haven't talked to Ms. Maher.
No. Well, we may come to that in questions for her. But again, whether or not a planning provision can be made clearer by removing words rather than adding them,
yes,
as a principle, not a rule, but a principle.
Yes. So, Policy 12, Fish and Game's Notice of Appeal requested that Policy 12 reflect these practice principles for offsetting and compensation. I should say here that these submissions are really split into two. The first part on Policy 12 talks about this relief of Fish and Game to reflect the best practice offsetting compensation principles, and then the second part responds to other parties' requests that provisions of Policy 12 be altered from the decisions version. So the only actual appeal point that Fish and Game had on Policy 12 was related to this offsetting and compensation principles. So, paragraph 5A, Fish and Game saw the legally binding mechanism for securing an offset compensation should be for at least the duration of the residual effect, and that the BBOT principles of additionality and demonstrability be referenced, that is, an offset compensation be demonstrated using appropriate methodology, and the offset compensation measure achieve outcomes above and beyond that which would have been achieved if it had not taken place. And so, Fish and Game relies on the evidence of Dr. Corkery, and appendices 6 and 7 to the NPSFM now give guidance on offsetting compensation in the aquatic area. I do note that Dr. Corkery is the only expert with speciality in offsetting and compensation given evidence here. Fish and Game now seek a definition of offset and compensation in accordance with the NPSFM 2020. And I note in the thing at footnote 3 that Fish and Game did seek a slightly different definition in its notice of appeal. However, the definitions in the NPSFM are broadly consistent with what was sought in the notice of appeal. And probably better for the definition of compensation. And a change to policy 12C, Roman numeral 4, states the offsetting compensation measure remains in place for at least the duration. And that's just a very small issue because parties have agreed that the measure remain in place for the duration. It's simply inserting the words at least, because sometimes the measure would naturally remain in place for a further duration, such as, for example, a constructive wet band or something.
It could be permanent.
Yes. So with the release of Appendices 6 and 7 to the NPSFM and the benefit of hearing Weeks 1 and 2 traversing Policy 5, which I will be submitting in the general hearing, that policy is not true offsetting and compensation. Fish and Game consider definitions are required, and it would help to distinguish the concept in Policy 12 from the concept in Policy 5. So the definitions sort of are set out there at the top of the next page. Paragraph 10, including definitions of offset and compensation would be consistent with Clause 4.1 of the NPSFM, which requires taxes to give effect to the NPSFM as soon as possible. Another reason these definitions are sought, rather than simply leaving it silent and having a consent officer look to high-level policy documents on a case-by-case basis, is that the Council have said a number of times that this isn't intended to be offsetting and compensation in accordance with the NPSFM. Mr. Trebolko said that in questioning. So there is a concern that there's a bespoke offsetting compensation provision here that is inconsistent with high-level policy. So I touch on in paragraph 11 the issue that I understand some people argue that the particular provision in the NPSFM that where you apply offset and compensation is the loss of extent or values of natural inland wetlands and rivers, and there is an argument at play as to whether that only applies where you have a loss of extent as well as a loss of values. So there is an argument going on, and we've had it in various hearings, about whether if you simply have a water quality effect, the offset and compensation provisions of the NPSFM technically apply. But
that's not the usual interpretation of OR, is it?
No, and actually it is problematic because throughout the NPSFM sometimes it says extent OR, and in other places it says, I believe it says extent and. So I submit that the court does not need to decide that issue because at paragraph 12 the principles in appendices 6 and 7 are well established. They're based on the BBOT principles developed internationally in response to biodiversity loss worldwide and being the subject of New Zealand guidance. Contained in the NPSFIB, and the effects management framework is also in the, that should say natural, not national, and Built Environments Act 2023. And Schedule 3 of that legislation also contains the principles for biodiversity offsetting and biodiversity compensation. So in all these places, the principles are broadly consistent because, of course, they stem from the BBOT principles. And I've set out in a footnote here Dr. Corkery's evidence on that. So the principles have been considered and applied by the New Zealand courts in plan provisions and in the context of notices of requirement and consent applications. Footnote 7, I've listed some cases where the principles have been applied in plan provisions, and in Appendix 2 to my submissions, I have referred to the Day versus Manawatu Wanganui Regional Council case, which was an Environment Court decision, and I've set out some of the paragraphs in that case. Which, not surprisingly, again, inserted into the Horizons 1 plan, the principles are consistent with the BVOP. So, I note at paragraph 13 that the concept of betterment is a judicial concept and does not carry the same rigour as do the concepts of offsetting and compensation. In summary, definitions accompanying the use of the term offset and compensation would give flesh to higher-level policy, to Te Re Whai Mana and the NPSFM, and, I submit, provide the necessary rigour. And this is in circumstances where offsetting in the aquatic context has not been overly successful in New Zealand. And again, I refer to Dr. Corkery's evidence, but the purpose of Mr. Klee's evidence in this case is to provide some examples on the ground where offsetting has been problematic in the Waikato region. So the definitions would also make it clear that offsetting differs from compensation. Compensation is sitting last in the effects management hierarchy. Now, at paragraph 15b, I've said that the definitions would also aid the interpretation of policy 13D, which is about staging, but that's actually one of the principles. It's not in the definition itself. And this was a concern of the parties for some time, whether offsets should be staged. And that principle says that for time lags, if you have a delay between the loss of extent or values at the impact site, again, of extent at the offset site is minimised so that the calculated gains are achieved, and you do that through things like multipliers. So these principles could aid rather than be detrimental to some of these discussions which parties have been having about whether you could stage offsetting and what happens if you do stage offsetting. And that's 13D. So the remainder of these submissions, as I said, respond to other parties' appeal points. If I can just diverge again, Fish and Game's main submission is that the decisions version did not need amending. And I go on into the detail, but Fish and Game doesn't consider that Mr. Trevelco's amendments that purport to reflect what the decision makers are intended are needed, and what the decision makers in the first instance intended is on the face of the provisions themselves. But as other council have said, certain policy settings have been agreed with other parties that Fish and Game doesn't agree with. So, I don't know if I need to go through this section on reasonable mixing and the best practicable option.
Well, perhaps I'll just ask you a question, Ms. Ong. Just in terms of your paragraph 18 there.
Yes.
Talking about policy 12. You have indicated there that you would support the proposed drafting that you have in your italics, which talks about including the passage including any reasonable mixing in accordance with policy 3.2.38. I'm a little confused though, because then in paragraph 19 you say you support the position of Waikato River Authority in terms of whether a mixing zone is inappropriate or not. The previous passage we just took you to doesn't talk about the appropriateness of mixing, and then I see in your footnotes
you say footnote 13, it is insufficient to simply refer to policy 3.2.38 of the plan for guidance because the policy wasn't written prior to Te Tuhi Whaimana, Te Tuhi Whaimana, and it doesn't give guidance on whether a mixing plan is appropriate or not in the context of Te Tuhi Whaimana.
Yes. Okay, I can explain that too.
That would be helpful.
So in policy 12, some parties, including Mr. Trebolco, want the words after any reasonable mixing or after any appropriate reasonable mixing occurs to be put at the end of policy 12.
Yes.
So the problem with that from Fish and Game's perspective is that policy 12 is all about what is the best practicable option.
Yes.
And so what Fish and Game's wording would do would mean that when you're assessing the best practicable option, you don't leave out the mixing zone issue. You include it in your BPO assessment. And that would include an assessment of whether a mixing zone is appropriate in the first place.
Perhaps you can clarify from the end whether the BPO identifies whether it's appropriate or not. So that I raised, I think, with Ms. Garvin, is appropriate to the activity as opposed to location.
Mm. Yes, in my submission, the guidance contained within the definition of the BPO would cover whether it's appropriate at that location.
Mm. Okay, right. Thank you.
Can I just raise this question about what one does with planning documents the sequence of planning documents and the submission that it's insufficient to refer to a policy in the regional plan for guidance because it was written prior to Te Tuhi Whaimana. Surely the real question is not the timing of the drafting of the policy, but whether substantively reading the policy and then considering Te Tuhi Whaimana, is that policy still appropriate to give effect to Te Tuhi Whaimana? And I'm just trying to bring up the regional plan to go back to policy 3.2.3.8. But if it does give effect to Te Tuhi Whaimana, then its age doesn't count against it.
Yes, I would agree with that, sir. I think Ms. Nair's opinion is that it doesn't. And Mr. Muldoon has put some questions to Mr. Trebolco on this, I believe, about the last couple of items in that policy 8,
right,
which talk about effects. But it's not explicit. So I think Ms. Nair's opinion is that both the age of the regional plan plus the fact that policy 3.2.3.8 don't cover the field. The problem with the drafting of applying the mixing zone after the BPO is simply that it indicates that the considerations of the BPO, the underlying considerations, don't apply to your mixing zone. So that is why Ms. Mara and some of the other planners have requested that it be placed in the middle of policy 12A. Arguably, you're mixing up the BPO consideration with the mixing zone consideration, but the Fish and Games planner is in the same camp as some of the other planners that actually that's what you should do. When you're considering the BPO, you're considering the mixing zone issue as well.
Yes, well, I mean, we were talking about this, the definition of BPO in the Act, which notionally has three limbs to it, each limb actually. Definition of BPO. NPO and the Act, which notionally has three limbs. Each limb actually has two limbs. And the way in which the definition is worded raises, you know, you go through that, you divide it up into the six limbs that exist, you consider what best means at the outset of it, and you say to yourself, well, is there in fact a structure within the BPO? Logically, there are certain things that can occur before other things can happen. But when you design something, such as a process which leads to a discharge, a good design process will take a step and then consider whether or not anything prior to that step needs to be reconsidered in light of the conclusion you reach at that step, and so on and so on. So that the process of design is not a straight line. It's actually a series of loops as it goes through. And again, there are principles that relate to these things, which don't necessarily lend themselves to succinct description in a statutory planning document.
That's right, sir, and often in these cases you have the teams doing the multi-criteria disciplinary analysis and things like that, but I would say that in those sorts of analyses they also take into account whether the actual discharge point is appropriate and feasible.
Well, indeed, but you know, as Mr. Pinter said, and as has been raised by His Honour on several occasions now, part of that may well be, should there be a discharge at all, should there be any kind of discharge of this nature in the other?
Yes, so that's the submission, sir, is that effectively the BPO does actually apply to the mixing zone, but
when you're thinking about it, if you reach the point where you say there has to be a discharge, then as others have said, and I think you must accept this, there will be a mixing zone, whether you like it or not.
Yes.
And then you go back and say, well, knowing that there'll be a mixing zone, is it appropriate to have the discharge?
Yes, exactly. And you consider the effects in that mixing zone. So the best solution would be to delete those words about with reasonable mixing altogether from Policy 12A, and in my submission words, rely on Policy 13J.
And similarly, perhaps in B1, recognise that significant adverse effects on aquatic life or toxic adverse effects would be contrary to 107.
Yes, so I do discuss that in my next paragraph, but again, I'll diverge from that because we've had a long discussion on that, and actually put forward that this provides an offsetting opportunity. There are limits to offsetting, and Fish and Game's view of the intent of this is that you shouldn't offset where, after reasonable mixing, the discharge is going to have significant and toxic or toxic effects, because that Fish and Game's planner opinion is that is inconsistent with the certifying limit. So it's as simple as that, really. I do note that Section 107 also refers to other things other than significant and toxic. It refers to the production of conspicuous oil grease films, conspicuous change in the colour of the liquid or clarity, rejection of odour. So these two have been singled out. Significant effects and Fish and Game submission is that there's a reason for that, and it's inconsistent with the sort of fine manner. I did hear the submissions of OG, but Fish and Game's position is it's simply not accepted that this should be provided for as an incentive for more inventive solutions that may be better than allowing toxic or significant effects after the mixing zone. So that's a difference between the two parties. Shall I move on to policy 12C? Policy 12C, 12 paragraph C begins, for the purpose of establishing if a discharge will have a residual adverse effect, the relevant considerations include. Now, parties are wanting to nail this down, so they have, and council has altered that word include to the word are. If I can diverge again, the submission is that policy 12 essentially provides an opportunity for offsetting. It says that offsetting measures should be proposed. And it's not necessarily necessary to nail it down to that extent, because there may be other things other than numerals 1 to 3 that are residual adverse effects that don't only relate to increases in the load and whether you're going to make the target at your states. Fish and Game accepts that is the main purpose of this provision, but doesn't want to exclude other things, and key examples would be effects on cultural values. Usually they would occur within the mixing zone, but you might have, for example, an effect of the discharge of E. coli, which has an effect on Modi outside the mixing zone that's not related to load, and that should be considered a residual adverse effect as well. Whether you actually offset it or not, because it may be very difficult to offset. My submission would be you consider it at the time. The offset is, you may not offer the offset in that situation, but you don't wish to preclude it altogether.
Is this an issue which is effectively bound up in or overtaken by activity statements? If these discharges are discretionary, then this policy can't turn them into restricted discretionary activities, can it?
That's right, and I think some parties are treating this as more of a role. It is, my understanding is it's discretionary, and Mr. Conway said that the reason that they can put policies in the plan like this without an associated role framework is because the role is quite generic.
Well, if we go back to what he identified, and I'd have to look in the regional plan, which I find hard to navigate. As I say, it just seems to me to be a question of whether or not this is seeking to restrict the consenting discretion, the boundaries of a consenting discretion, similar to the way you would for a restricted, controlled or restricted discretionary activity. But if it were a full discretionary activity, I would have thought the statutory provisions in section 104 to 104D would overtake it.
Yes, the provisions that you have regard to, not sure where you're getting to, sir, whether you think that the policy should be made broader or narrower, but I think in some cases if you make this policy narrower so that applicants have a desire to wish to know what they're up for, so to speak.
Which is a fair expectation.
Yes, that is fair. But then there's the possible disadvantage that you are then indicating that for other residual adverse effects, they don't count. So, yeah, the policy, if it's phrased with C1 to 3 providing the main part of guidance for what the policy is trying to achieve, but not precluding the possibility that there may be other residual adverse effects in a particular case, would, in my submission, be preferable.
Maybe the problem is not with the words include or are, the problem is with the words relevant considerations and whether or not, if it is a policy to guide an applicant as to what they ought to focus on, then the words relevant considerations should be replaced by other words that give that indication.
Yes, yes, that could be another solution, so long as it's not indicated to be exclusive as the solution.
Well, you wouldn't insert words such as you'll get your consent if you do this.
Yes. No, I don't think Fish and Game would like that.
No, that's what I suspected there. Notwithstanding the extent to which those words may be used at the front counter. But it may be that that's the real problem, is that the word is relevant. The problem word is relevant.
Yes.
And it may well be that if what you're saying on behalf of your client is that you'd like these to be possibly principal considerations, but not the only considerations.
That's what I am saying on behalf of my client. I do also note in paragraph 26 of my submission that everywhere elsewhere Ofsted has set out in high level policy, and the examples I've given in case law, you don't define what a residual adverse effect is. Now, I do acknowledge that this is possibly one of the first plans that has dealt with offsetting and compensation in the water quality area. But certainly in the terrestrial environment, you don't say these are the only considerations for considering what's a residual adverse effect. And then I set out 3.21 of the NPSFM, which is the effects management hierarchy. And so the way that the 3.21 and many other offsetting documents deal with this is that you offset more than minor residual adverse effects. So that's the only limitation for offsetting in many of the high-level policy documents and the BBOC. You don't offset effects that are less than minor, you offset effects that are more than minor. So I know you don't like that phrase, Your Honour.
I'm not as set against it as some of my colleagues. But I do, I think the important thing is when it's used in this sort of context in terms of a hierarchy, it may be that the hierarchy provides a context to enable it to be understood.
So finally, so for the above reasons, Fish and Game seeks to retain the word include in the Chapeau to Policy 12C. If I can delete where it says to delete the word load in 12B, 5 and 6, and C1. But it does wish to delete the word load in C3, which is this damming and diversion issue, which Ms. Mark can speak to.
So it's simply 12C3 is where you want to stay.
Is stay everywhere else in 2? Yes. 12.3 is basically remain as the decisions version. Yes. And not change it to load. And to include the concept of additionality. So that's set out in the provisions that I've tabled. Now, the only other point in my appendix two, as I said, I set out an excerpt from Dave versus San Antonio Woman Regional Council, and I neglected to provide the citation reference for the final decision where these provisions were established in that 2012 New Zealand Environment Court 285. I see reference there because that was an interim decision. So I'll just review that reference.
Sorry, 2012.
NZENVC 285. And so they provisions set out on the result and directions of the decision 3-19 on the last page of my submissions. That's now contained in policy 13.4 of the Horizons 1 plan, 13.4D. And as I've been proposing to witnesses, that these aren't new principles, that decision was in 2012. So, those are my submissions.
Thank you. Now, we've got one of your witnesses beaming in, but you've got Mr. Clay present.
Yes, I have.
What order are you? Him first?
Yes, Mr. Clay, I'll follow Mr. Clay, thank you.
Solemnly, sincerely, and truthfully declare and affirm with the evidence we are about to give this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Your full name is David Clune.
Correct.
And you have prepared a statement of evidence dated 28 July 2023.
Correct.
And you are a signatory to the joint. I'll list these, the joint witness statement, Freshwater, 6 September 2023, the joint witness statement, Lakes, 31 August 2023, and the joint witness statement, Wetlands, 30 August 2023. Do you confirm that your statement of evidence, you have the qualifications of experience set out in your evidence?
Yes.
And do you have any corrections to make?
No.
And do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge?
Yes, I do.
Please answer any questions.
Conway, thank you, Jerry. Thank you. Ms. Chapman.
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Mulder.
No, thank you, sir.
Mr. Mulder.
Thank
you. Thank you. Ms. Garland.
No, thank you, sir.
No,
thank you, sir.
No, thank you, sir.
No, thank you, sir.
Another one who gets off scot-free.
Thank you. Maybe not next time.
Yes. Is Ms. Mara online?
Yeah.
So I call Ms. Mara. Your name is Helen Marie Ma. I think you're on mute. No, it's not working.
Ms. Kim, will you just check our system? Again, no luck. Can you hear us, Ms. Ma? Yes? Okay.
Is there anyone else online, sir, who could maybe see if it's still put in the court system?
Yes, can I just ask, is there anybody else who's watching this transmission and who obviously can hear us? Hello? Okay. If you are you speaking? No, so we can't hear either side. Do we need to do a reset?
All right. I'm going to hang up and try to call.
Okay, we're going to hang up and try to reconnect, and it may mean that you need to reconnect as well. So give us a couple of minutes. I'm just wondering if we take... are there many questions from Ms. Ma?
Yes, I certainly have some, sir.
All right. How long do you think you might be?
20-odd minutes.
Any other questions from Ms. Ma? All right.
It's just 5 minutes, sir.
All right. Well, I'm going to suggest we're actually, I think we're fine in terms of...
Welcome to...
Not sure how long this process takes. Now, Ken, who's on the line? Can you hear me? And we still can't hear you. Just check your microphone is switched on. And Ms. Kim, just check that we should have audio coming through. And try again. No? All right. Ms. Ma, can you speak?
Hello.
There we
Hello?
Are. Success. Very good. All right. So let's just have you on screen. If we can, if others could turn. There we are. Excellent.
Thank you, sir.
Now, Ms. Ma, I'll just start by asking you whether you solemnly and sincerely declare and affirm that the evidence that you will give in this proceeding will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you very much. Please proceed, Ms. Wong.
Thank you, sir. Your name is Helen Marie Ma?
Yes.
And you have filed two statements of evidence in these proceedings, one dated 28 July 2023 and a rebuttal dated 11 August 2023. Do you have any corrections to make to those statements?
Yes, I have two corrections I'd like to make, please.
If you could take the report through. Thank
you. Yes. In paragraph 188, at the bottom of the page, after policy 12, I would like to delete the words to narrow its application to loads of contaminants only, comma, and on the next page in paragraph 189, in the second sentence which begins in particular, I would like to delete the words, his new B Roman 5 should be broadened, comma, and. own corrections.
Sorry, just repeat that amendment in 189.
In a sentence that begins in particular,
yes.
I would like to delete the words, his new B room 5 should be broadened, comma, and.
Yes.
So the sentence reads, in particular, C rooms 2.
Thank you.
You have the qualifications and experience set out in your evidence in chief?
I do.
And you were a signatory to two planning JWS's, one dated 14 September and the point source JWS dated 18 September. Do you confirm that the evidence you've given in these proceedings and will give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Thank you. Please answer any questions.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Ms. Ma. Can you see
good afternoon.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I can't see Ms. Comet. Oh, now I can see you.
Oh, great. Thank you. Now, I'd like to ask you some questions that centre around the point source discharges joint witness statement. Have you got that handy?
I'll bring that up on my screen.
And the first question I have relates to question 2. The very end of that question, which is on bundle page 401.0172.
Yes.
And this relates to policy 11, and you've sought there the deletion of the words have regard to, where it refers to objective 1. You recall that?
Yes.
Now, in terms of the point in time at which this policy would apply in the context of a resource consent application, is that right?
Yes.
And at a resource consent application stage, the requirement in section 104 is to have regard to relevant plan provisions?
That's correct.
So in terms of the level of weight that is being given, it's to the reference to objective 1. If this reference were to remain in the policy, the words have regard to there would at least be consistent with section 104.
Yes, the words have regard to are words in section 104. I think the context in policy 11 is somewhat different to that, because policy 11 relates to providing for point source discharges for regionally significant infrastructure and industry. So that's a directive policy, and having that directive policy only having regard to the overall objective of the plan seems to me to create an inconsistency within the chapter itself, because policy 11 ought to be achieving policy 1, not having regard to it.
Turning to policy 12K, in relation to, step 4 12B on page 401.0176.
In the joint witness statement.
Yes, that's right. Yes. That's right. Now, the third, or the last line in the table relating to policy 12 relates to your preference to delete exacerbate in that policy. We're talking about exacerbate. Oh, sorry, your preference is to retain the phrase or the meaning of exacerbate the rate or location. Now, looking at that policy and the way that it's worded, can you understand Mr. Trebilco's concern that the phrase exacerbate the rate or location of contaminants suffers from a degree of uncertainty or lack of clarity?
I agree that the words aren't optimal. If I was drafting the policy from scratch, I probably wouldn't use that phrasing. That's phrasing that the hearing panel went with. Mr. Trebelco's recommendation is to change the wording to delete those words entirely. Given the choice of deleting them entirely or keeping them, I think that keeping them is more appropriate and gives better effects, better achieves the objectives of the plan.
Thank you. If
Mr. Burkow's problem is that the words are unclear, I think a better option would be to make the words clear rather than delete them entirely.
And his approach was to change this to refer to increasing the load, which I think we're all on the same page that the load is important. The question is simpler from your perspective, perhaps, is that can something of the meaning of race or location be retained here rather than simply disposed of in reference to load? Is that fair?
That's right, because load, when you're talking about a damming or diversion of water, it's not just the load that's important, it's where that load arrives and the effects that it has in that location, not just the load.
Have you given any thought to how the intent of the original wording could be retained but in a clearer way than the existing, than the decisions version?
I haven't done any detailed drafting for that. I would have to take some time rather than coming up with drafting on the hoof.
That's fine, I appreciate that. Now, the last point I want to touch on here relates to the wording in policy 12C, and there's been some discussion of it today, where the council's version replaces include with are.
Mm.
And I don't have Mr. Trebelco's view on this yet, but can I have yours, please? If the words at the end of 12C were to be changed from the relevant considerations include or are to simply say consider, do you think that would improve the wording from in relation to the concern you have about Mr. Trebelco's version?
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. Ms. Chapman.
Can you see me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, good. Okay, thank you. I'd like to follow on from a couple of questions that my friend Mr. Conway asked you in relation to policy 11, and he's covered some of the questions that I have here. But in terms of thinking about that reference to objective 1 in policy 11, other policies in the plan aren't subject to objective 1, are they?
I'm just looking for policy 2. No, I can't think of another policy that uses that phrasing subject 2, objective 1. Policy 1 and 2 do cross-reference the need to achieve the target attribute state. And there are similar cross-references in some of the farm, the EPP schedules. So cross-referencing that the purpose of taking particular measures is in order to achieve the target attribute states. And those target attribute states do form part of objective 1 and 2. But the word subject 2 is not used in those non-point source provisions that I can think of off the top of my head.
No, and that doesn't mean that those policies don't have to have regard to objective 1, does it?
Well, the policies are there to achieve the objective, so they ought to be written in a way that achieves the objective. In a resource consenting scenario, a decision maker has to have regard to all of the provisions in the plan.
That's right. And to the extent that there are cross references in those other disuse discharge policies, there are also cross references in the point source discharge policies to achieving the target attribute states, aren't there?
Yes, to achieve steady progression.
Yes, in policies 12 and 13, I think you find five of those.
Yes, they both refer to the target, the interim target attribute states and the attribute states. Yes, they do.
And so, in terms of policy 11, what do you think that it means for the continued operation and development of regionally significant industry and infrastructure to be subject to Objective 1?
My reading of Policy 11 is that it's directing decision makers to provide for those regionally significant measures, but that provision is not at the expense of achieving Objective 1 and 2. And my understanding is that reading of it would be consistent with G35 Mana and with the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, which sets out a priority, which is that the why comes first. We provide for our needs, but not at the expense of the why.
So you referred to Objective 1 and 2. But there's no reference to Objective 2 in Policy 11, is there?
No, there's not.
No. And you still would consider that Objective 2 has to be considered with respect to Policy 11?
Well, when we're writing Policy 11, we have to ensure that the provisions achieve the objectives. When we're making a decision on a resource consent, then the decision maker has to have regard to all of the provisions.
So is there any reason in your view why there is not reference to Objective 2?
I can't recall the hearing panel's reasoning around why they pulled out Objective 1. Possibly it's because they were taking the long-term view, and regionally significant infrastructure and industry often is operating under long-term consents that go beyond the life of the plan, so having that longer-term view towards the long-term target attribute stage rather than just the 10-year one might be more relevant in that consideration.
But you can certainly have shorter-term point source discharge consent, can't you?
You can, yes.
Okay, and so in your mind, in terms of the way that the drafting operates, you can't see any clear reason why there is no reference to Objective 2?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
And so it remains your view that there still needs to be a reference to Objective 1?
I think if Policy 11 is going to refer to Objective 1, it should do that in an appropriate way, which is that there is a need to achieve Objective 1, not having regard to the need to achieve it. But I'm not of a firm view that the policy needs to cross-reference Objective 1 in this scenario. I think it is not technically necessary.
Okay, thank you. So, moving on. Still talking about Policy 11. If you have a look at your evidence in chief at paragraph 175 and the reference is 319.0278.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't quite hear the last part of your question. I can move away from the microphone possibly.
I think you actually need the other desktop, one of those microphones pointed more directly to you. We've got different microphones for different purposes.
Right, so we need both. Okay.
You need both. You need the full press conference style.
Excellent. Is that better? Can you hear me a little more?
I can.
Okay.
Yes.
So I was asking you to turn to your evidence in chief at paragraph 175. Have you got that?
I've got that, yes.
And you say there that provisions in the regional policy statement relative to regionally significant industry recognise the need for regionally significant industry to access natural resource, but also require that adverse effects are avoided, remedied or mitigated. And you make reference to policy IMP4 of the regional policy statement at your footnote.
Mm-hmm.
Then you say, I do not find anything in the RPS that indicates that regionally significant infrastructure or industry occupies a special place in the RPS scheme of managing effects on water quality.
Yes.
So with reference to that policy IMP4, would you like to turn that up?
We just need to find it.
So the reference is 501.0249 of the electronic copy of the RPS.
I have it on my screen, I'm just reading it in full. Okay.
So, given that you've just read it, I won't repeat it back to you, but it's not just about the RPS provisions recognising the need for access, is it? It's more specifically about maintenance and enhancement in terms of that subclause 5.
Maintaining and where appropriate, enhancing access to physical, natural and physical resources. Yes,
that's right. And so those natural and physical resources would include access to water too, wouldn't they?
And I would assume so, yes.
And so having regard to that distinction, do you still maintain that there's no special place in the RPS scheme for regionally significant industry in the scheme of managing effects on water quality?
Yes, I don't read that policy as saying that regionally significant industry has, sorry, let me start again. The policies that deal with how we manage adverse effects on water quality don't draw out regionally significant industry as having a different management approach to effects on water quality. It says in all cases that those adverse effects are to be avoided, remedied or mitigated.
But there is a recognition too, isn't there, that there are other aspects to that, including maintaining and where appropriate enhancing access. So there's a recognition of the need for regionally significant industry in relation to those natural and physical resources.
Yes, okay. Along with primary production as well.
Yes. At your paragraph 179, when you're talking about policy 11, you say that to achieve objective 1, all contributors of contaminants will need to play a part. Are you aware of any evidence in these proceedings that point source discharges have not played their part in improving their discharges and the contributions that they make to water quality?
No.
No, thank you. And that has happened to date without the benefit of these policies in place, hasn't it?
Oh, that PC1, yes.
You say that references in the policies 12 and 13 are to target attribute states, but those references are only considerations and not directions. But I've previously...
Which paragraph are you referring to?
Sorry, that's paragraph 181. an answer to a question from my friend Mr. Conway, you acknowledge that policy 12 is directive. Is that correct?
Is your question, is policy 12 directive?
Yes.
It's a funny policy because it's a mixture of both. It does have some direction. For example, it requires demonstrations of BPO. But then it also has wording like you should be proposed, which is not directive. And then it also has considerations. So as a policy, it is quite a mixed bag of direction and consideration matters.
Yes, it's effectively compelling the applicant to propose measures, isn't it, in relation to offsetting and compensation where there is a residual adverse effect?
Well, because it uses the phrase measures should be proposed, I don't read it as compelling. I read it as the policy is setting an expectation that should be proposed, but I don't think it, on the other hand, it doesn't set a clear direction that if you don't propose those, then your proposal is inappropriate. As other witnesses yesterday pointed out, there are other provisions in the regional the Waikato Regional Plan that deal with charges and how they should be managed, that provide an avoid, remedy, mitigate framework, avoid, remedy, or mitigate adverse effects. I see policy 12 as adding the opportunity for offsetting compensation to that mix for regionally significant industry.
And so if an applicant was proposing to offset or compensate in accordance with policy 12, but where an applicant wasn't able to necessarily comply with all of those provisos in policy 12, is that where you would see policies 11 and 13 coming into play?
In addition to the other policies in the regional plan that deal with addressing adverse effects.
Yes. Thank you. So just thinking about policy 11 again, Dr. Mitchell in his rebuttal evidence says that policy 11 doesn't provide the means by which Te Ture Whai Mana can be ignored. Would you agree with that?
Yes, it's not possible to ignore Te Ture Whai Mana.
Right, I'd like to ask you some questions about the exceptions in section 107, reference to the exceptions in in clause policy 12B1 to section 107(2). And your view is that this should not be included, is that correct?
Yes.
So I just want to explore this with you for a moment, but is your opposition to the grant of any consent on the basis of exceptional circumstances where there are those significant effects, or is it, just in relation to this provision, or is it a more general opposition to the use of section 107(2)?
My evidence is in relation to what is the most appropriate wording for policy 12B1. So it is not a generalised opinion about section 107(2) that exists, that is the law. What I was turning my mind to in my evidence was where there are residual adverse effects offsetting or compensation is being considered. Should the decisions version says that offsetting and compensation is not appropriate where there are aquatic significant adverse effects or toxic adverse effects. So what I was considering was, is it more appropriate for that consideration to be subject to some exceptions or just to stand on its own? So I turned my mind to what is the best way to achieve the objectives of the plan, which relate to Te Ture Whai Mana and achieving the target attribute states, and also what best gives effect to the higher order, order documents, Te Ture Whai Mana and the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management. It's my understanding that significant adverse effects on aquatic life and toxic adverse effects go directly to the health and well-being of a water body. Both Te Ture Whai Mana and the NPCFM and the objectives talk about restoring and upholding the health and well-being of the water bodies. So in that context, and I thought, is it more appropriate to allow those effects or not to allow those effects to be offset, and which means that those effects aren't addressed at the site, they're addressed at another site. It's my opinion that it's more consistent with the higher order documents for those effects to be addressed at the site, not somewhere else.
So have you been listening into the hearing yesterday and today?
Yes, I have.
So have you heard the discussion in relation to the evidence that OG gave with respect to its wastewater treatment system upgrade?
I did hear that discussion, yes.
And in that scenario, there was a reliance on exceptional circumstances where there were some significant adverse effects in a tributary, but there was a significant improvement that was achieved over and above previous discharges further downstream and before entry into Lake Maraetai itself. You heard that, or were you familiar?
I did hear the evidence, but I'm not familiar with the facts of the case. I haven't read the consent documents.
No, but what I'd like to ask you is, in that scenario where there may well be significant adverse effects in a tributary, but there is an overall improvement, what would you prefer the applicant to do in that situation? Would you prefer them to propose offsetting and compensation, or would you prefer that they not do that?
I don't think it's appropriate for me to state preferences about a particular case. What I've provided evidence on is what should the words in the plan be and what are the most appropriate words to give effect to those higher order documents and achieve the objectives. And I think that NPSFM and Te Ture Whai Mana are really clear about safeguarding the health and wellbeing of water bodies and throughout their entire length. And it doesn't seem to me that a toxic adverse effect in one place could be offset in another place and achieve those higher order, the directions of the higher order documents.
So
my evidence is that it's more appropriate to have a limit to offsetting and compensation along those lines.
So I can appreciate that you may not want to comment on a specific situation, but if that were a hypothetical example, in other words, where you're having the discharge into a tributary, but where there is a significant improvement, and this is dealing with a replacement consent amendment, whether you would still prefer, or you think it appropriate for the policy to provide for that applicant the opportunity to propose offsetting or compensation.
It's almost impossible to think about hypotheticals without a whole lot of other hypothetical facts. But it seems to me that your question is that there's a choice between betterment and offsetting. And I think that the higher order documents are directing us towards a step change in our thinking that says we need both. We need to deal with the overall impacts that accumulate in the main stem and deal with localised adverse effects and tributaries, because that's what is required to achieve health and wellbeing across the entire length of the rivers.
So, from what you're saying, am I correct in taking it that really this is about ensuring consistency with the NPS FM?
And to define them.
And to define
them. I see those two operating together in this context.
Okay. So, just thinking about that a little bit more. I think you've acknowledged that there is some complexity to the point source discharge policies, particularly policy 12. I don't think there's any disagreement in relation to that.
No, they are very complex policies.
Indeed. And we have a situation, do we not, where we have an NPS FM which has been updated since these policies were drafted, which of course further complicates the situation. Now, you'd accept also that let's just focus on policy 12, that policy 12 is dealing with both new discharges and replacement discharges, replacement consent for existing discharges.
Yes, it does. I think that adds to the complexity, dealing with existing and new and discharges to land and water.
Thank you, you've answered my next question. And again, I don't think there's any disagreement in that regard. But I want you to think about that in terms of the NPS FM and what that actually requires in terms of the application of the effects management hierarchy. And perhaps if I could get you to turn to that document. And have you got a hard copy of it?
I have got a hard copy.
For the court, that is 501... 0.0094. So at the bottom of that page, which is page 23, in case you haven't got the numbering.
Thank you.
We've got a definition there of loss of value, haven't we? And that means that the river, if we're just talking about rivers rather than wetlands, the river is less able to provide for those existing values. Would you accept that in relation to a discharge, which is making an improvement, but perhaps not quite the extent of improvement that is required by objective 1 and/or 2 of the plan, that there is in fact not a loss of value, there is an improvement in value, but the improvement is just not quite enough to get us towards that long-term achievement of objective 1?
Yes, that would depend on the point at which USS is less able to provide for, and whether that is the environment with the discharge or the environment without the discharge. And I'm not sure what the correct legal interpretation of that is at this point, sorry. I don't know that there's been a case on that.
You're probably not alone. But my point is that when we are talking about the definition of the effects management hierarchy, or when we are talking about policy 3.24 of the NPS FM, which is on page 99 or page 28 in your version,
yes,
we're talking about that policy, which the NPS FM requires to be put into the Waikato Regional Plan, and indeed which is already in the Waikato Regional Plan as a result of this NPS. And that policy refers to the loss of river extent and values being avoided. And then it talks about, in subclause B, unless the council is satisfied that there is a functional need for the activity and the effects of the activity are managed by applying the effects management hierarchy. So there is some question here in relation to replacement discharges, isn't there, as to whether or not this policy actually applies to that scenario.
Yes, but I'm not sure the answer to that.
No, and that's a matter for legal submission, but my point is that we are trying to, would you agree, shoehorn the NPSFM provisions into a policy that wasn't written with that particular NPS or the effects management hierarchy in mind, and that perhaps it is better to attempt to rewrite it as part of a freshwater planning review rather than to undertake that shoehorning exercise here.
I disagree with the characterisation of shoehorning. I think it is a requirement on us to give effects to the NPS FM as far as we practically can within the scope of submissions. And I don't think I've seen anybody try to shoehorn NPS FM considerations in, but rather to assess the alternatives that are on the table and to use the alternative that is most consistent or best gives effects to the NPSFM.
But you wouldn't disagree that if you were going to do it in a manner that was entirely consistent with the NPSFM, that you might actually have to undertake a rewriting exercise of Policy 12.
To completely give effect to the NPSFM, we will need to rewrite PC1 entirely.
Yes.
So,
and
including Policy 12.
And there is a danger, isn't there, that we could end up with some unintended consequences, particularly in relation to replacement discharges, by trying to apply the provisions of the NPSFM that aren't designed to apply in that situation.
I can't think of any part of the NPSFM that is not designed to apply to point source discharges.
Well, we've just had that discussion about the loss of value and the fact that that policy doesn't apply. So, isn't that a situation where the NPS should not necessarily be applied to replacement discharges?
Well, the policy that's been inserted into the regional plan as required by the NPSFM already applies to point source discharges, so it's already part of the plan.
Okay, I think that's probably a matter for legal submission, so I won't take that any further.
You have much more.
I do have a little more, actually, probably about 10 minutes.
Yes, well then I think we should take the break now and return at 15:15. Ms. Maher, I need to give the usual direction, but in your situation you're not here, so don't speak to anyone about the evidence that you're giving, I suppose, either over the computer or using your telephone, but you'll be on your own anyway, I expect. You can be back at 2:15?
Yes, I can, understood.
All right. Well, then we're adjourned until 2:15. Thank you.
don't actually have hard copies on these, so I haven't written them. Just send me an email, I'll probably make sure that I see that.